Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today by news editor Bradley Gerard. How are you doing, Bradley?
Good, John. Thank you.
Good. And tips editor Algie Hall. How are you doing, Algie?
Hi. Very good. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. How's the desk working out for you?
Lovely. Yeah.
I've got a bare back myself now. I think I might get one. Right. So anyway, it's been a kind of mad week. Again, some mad stuff's happened today, which obviously isn't in the magazine, not least the High Court ruling on the triggering of Article 50, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, that's going to cause some debates around the Sunday lunch dinner table, isn't it?
Not my Sunday lunch dinner table. But yeah, I mean, sterling shot up again today against both dollar and the euro, and I presume other currencies as well. They're the only ones I've looked at. But yeah, I mean, fascinating stuff. Obviously, we've got an election going on in the United States, and that's all gone kind of in the opposite direction from where it was going a week ago, which is also quite mad.
Yeah, it's quite worrying, actually. We got sent some stats from one of the I think it was Odds Checker, actually, who checks sort of odds across the market. And the way in which the betting is going in terms of whether Clinton or Trump will win is very similar to how Brexit was. So much more money, I think, was put on Remain, but more bets were put on Leave, and Leave won. And it's the same thing again. Much more money is on Clinton, but there are a greater number of bets on Trump.
Yeah, I think I saw a stat the last few days that's 91% of bets are on a Trump victory now,
which is crazy. And it does kind of scare me a little bit, because it kind of really does make you think, actually. Well, of course, I mean, it's almost a two-horse race, isn't it? There are other candidates, but it's basically a two-horse race, so obviously he has a chance of winning, but that fact is quite scary.
Indeed. Actually, this is something that Chris Dillo has talked about in his comment pieces this week, When Markets Fail, and talking about how betting markets can get things so wrong, which they obviously did in the case of the well, you say you say they got them wrong, but actually, if the majority are what we're listening to, then they got it right.
Well, exactly, yeah.
But yeah, anyway, Chris Dillo has looked at this week in his usual fantastic way, so that's worth a read. I've mentioned the US presidential election in my column because I think it's quite interesting. Markets have obviously reacted to the fact that Trump has either narrowed the gap to Clinton, or, according to some polls, overtaken, and markets have taken fright at this. But my view is, well, what difference does it make? You know, I mean, Trump has said some mad things, but he still has to get this stuff pushed through the law making system in America, and that's not necessarily going to happen whether he becomes president or not.
No, let's face it, the Congress and the Senate are sort of unruly beasts. So
yes, indeed, and he doesn't exactly have the backing of the Republican Party that we've seen over the last month. Anyway, that's fascinating. What have we actually got in the magazine? Let's start with 7 days, Bradley.
Yeah, I guess on the sort of staying on a higher level macro sort of theme, I suppose, there's an interesting bit of research by Willis Towers Watson, which they co-compiled. And it looked at the amount of money run by the world's 500 largest fund managers. And this actually fell for the first time in 5 years, which is quite interesting. And that the amount that went out was bigger than the amount that went out during the financial crisis. And a big drain on assets has been sovereign wealth funds, many of which are run by oil-dependent economies. So it's quite interesting. So this sort of pressure on the oil price has obviously created pressure on economies which rely a lot on oil revenue for their finances. And so obviously what they've been doing to supplement that income is actually withdrawing a lot of the money they invest. So this has had quite a large effect on sort of very large scale of asset managers, which is quite an interesting, just as an interesting sort of macro investment sort of trends going on.
So the withdrawal of funds is not necessarily a risk-off based decision, not necessarily a fear-based decision, more a practical decision.
Yeah, it's almost like sort of like financial management decision in a way. You know, an element of their portfolio, if you will, their oil income is not what it was, and so they're having to think about that in a more strategic way.
All right, while we're on the subject of oil, should we talk about the lead story in the news section, which is Shell BP, which both announced third quarter results this week?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, normally they move, as Alex Newman rightly says in the first paragraph, that normally their share prices move pretty much in tandem, if all things being equal, obviously. But yeah, Shell produced what the market saw as much more favourable results than BP, even though BP's weren't terrible. But Shell just seems to have that bit more impetus behind it. I mean, Alex sort of talks about the fact that Shell is definitely obviously very keen to manage its near-term cash flows. It's expecting its investments in 2017 to be at the lower end of previous guidance, which obviously gives a bit more confidence around the dividend, that type of thing.
That's what we're worried about, really, with Shell.
Well, that's what everyone's worried about. I mean, BP and Shell are just such big dividend stocks in the UK. They're in everyone's pension fund, pretty much, I would guess.
Strong dollar, or rather weak pound, must be working for them as well, certainly if you're receiving their income.
Yes, precisely. That is a good thing at the moment. Obviously, it'd be very interesting in 2 weeks' time if we have a Trump president and increased litigation about Brexit, then we could be back to where we were almost prior to the referendum. You could have the pound strengthening, the dollar weakening. Then I don't know, but
it all sounds like volatility to me.
It does, yeah. Basically normal market machinations, I suppose, but on a enhanced scale at the moment.
Not that normal. Well,
markets move normal, but yeah, I mean, the amount they might move in the Trump presidency, I suppose, yes, that's not normal. That's
yeah. So of the two, we still prefer Shell.
Yep, that's Alex's view. We prefer Shell as in terms of our preferred London listed integrated oil major play. The BG acquisition seems to have gone very well for them, and. Yeah, with BP, I mean, its upstream division recorded a $942 million loss for the year. So while one of their measures of profitability was ahead of consensus expectations, that division is struggling, and that's obviously a bit of a worry, which is why Shell went up for and BP went down for.
Let's talk about Alex's other story, because this is another big one this week. A lot of our readers will be interested in that, Sirius Minerals, which has decided it's going to raise a huge amount of money.
Yes, and actually, it's done so very quickly. It basically today actually has said that it's pretty much raised all of the money it wanted to.
$1.2 billion.
Yes, but importantly, there is a retail element to its fundraising, which remains open, I understand, having spoken to Alex this morning. So while the story sort of looks as if, in a way, it's already sort of kind of mostly played out, the part of the reason why we were very interested in it was that there is this retail element, that's still open. People can still get on board with this very, very interesting project, which has had some sort of high profile backing recently. Australia's Hancock Prospecting chucked in a big load of money a few weeks ago to support it. It's a big potash project, basically, is the simplest way to put it.
Yeah, and then there's been lots of concerns about whether it would actually ever be able to get this project off the ground, but it's looking close to becoming a reality.
Yeah, I mean, there's...
So, I mean, the shares fell on the back of the fundraising.
Which you would expect, yeah.
Because of the sheer scale of it.
Yeah.
But actually, there's a lot of support for it, suggesting the project has legs.
Alex actually wrote a very good blog on this probably a couple of months back now. So if you just type Sirius Minerals into our search engine online, you'll find it pretty easily. And he was writing at the time that the share price had just gone up an awful lot. And so investors should be very sort of careful about what that's baking in, basically, because as you say, yes, there's a lot of confidence behind this stock, there's a lot of belief what they're aiming to do can happen, but they are a long way off of actually doing it. So a lot of hope is in that share price, even in spite of it having come down quite a lot because of the fundraising.
Indeed, it's a bit of a Marmite stock, as we once displayed publicly in the tip section before I note you became editor of the tip section.
I've learned that lesson.
Yeah, so I think we talked about this on the podcast before. We ran a buy and a sell in the cell, and we got so much abuse from some people. But some people quite liked it. But
I mean, it's one of those stocks. If you've backed it up to now, you could have made a lot of money. If you stay in there, it's very speculative.
But like, if you bought it at the wrong time, you could have lost a lot of money.
True. Well, yeah, if you bought it probably a few weeks ago, now it's not looking so good. But there is a reason for that, the fundraising. So, but yeah, it is a speculative play. I think if you're going to invest in it, you need to be very, very sort of cognizant of that.
And we're saying hold.
We are.
Might as well, if you're in there already.
Yeah.
But certainly not one we'd encourage chasing now, given the speculative nature.
Not quite yet, no.
Let's talk about the 7 days. JD Sports is a company we do like. We've always been positive on. I think it's in the perma-buy category, pretty much.
Yeah, we tipped it at a very good time.
We tipped it loads of times.
We tipped it kind of close to the bottom. Julia Bradshaw, I think.
But it's a great business, but they've done something this week that is quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's... arguably, in a sense, it could be seen as a relatively normal thing to do. But the reason we thought we'd cover it is just because it makes the stock potentially more accessible to sort of private investors, obviously like our readers and listeners. The share price has gone up an awful lot, and as Algie said, we've tipped it regularly and at the right times, and we're a strong supporter of it. But what they're going to do is split the shares to basically make the share price a bit cheaper. So it's not a worry if you're in it. You'll still own the same. The same proportion of the company, or just be in the form of a greater number of shares, so yeah. Not really being diluted, but yeah, there is the it sort of just makes the share price optically come down, and therefore one can buy it.
15 quid,
it's not insane. Obviously there are shares that are much more costly in pounds than that, but maybe the value orientated customer of JD is similar to its investor.
Yeah, indeed. I know she's got a little story on insurance here, which seems to be doing very well at the moment.
Yeah, it's an interesting sector because we've got the sort of demerger going on over at Esure. And yeah, this was about moneysupermarket.com, which basically sales were up 12% in its insurance products, and it's just a part of the market that seems to be doing very, very well indeed. And we had an update, I think it was from Hastings Group, which only listed quite recently, which is more car insurance than sort of broader insurance. But yeah, they're doing very well as well. So it's a part of the market that's pretty robust at the moment.
Which one's Money Supermarket? Epic Strutter?
Yes.
Epic Strutter. I noticed they're also talking about energy switching here as well, which has done well for them. I switched the energy supplier this week.
Did you? Good. Yeah. I urged you to do that, I remember.
You did. I did it, Bradley. Good. I followed your advice. And I'm going to save about £500 a year.
It's not to be sniffed at.
It's not, certainly not.
Although, we switched recently and we just got a bill through saying we're having to put up the amount we charge.
Yeah, but I've gone into a fixed rate deal for 12 months and then I'll switch again.
No, we were on a fixed rate deal. We are, but they say we use more electricity than they had originally estimated.
Yeah, but it's the price, your unit price that you're fixed at, isn't it? So
yeah.
You might use... Well, just stop using
That's
so much
okay,
electricity.
Okay,
I know, what
right.
are you up to?
I felt cheated anyway. As a consumer, that's my right.
You felt cheated because you happen to use more yeah. electricity. I don't think that's what switching is all about. yes, anyway, I use the old Zoopla thing. You switch.
Okay, yeah, that's what I use, yeah.
Yeah, it's good, easy. Yeah. Easy peasy. This is not an endorsement, but it was very easy. Okay, pay. I know this has made its way into the sector. Moaning about pay again?
Well, not necessarily moaning. I mean, the Investment Association has a list of principles which it updates annually, and it's just done that again. And this is surrounding the way in which listed companies should approach the payment of their executives and their staff, and the way in which that pay is presented to investors, and to make it easy and understandable.
Staff more, executives less.
Yes, well, that that's on your placard. I'm not sure that's in the
not in their recommendations. No, get it all wrong.
Although I say that, I mean, they do, one of their suggestions was to put a ratio in which would show how much more the executive team is being paid compared to its employees, which obviously on a PR level would potentially put the buffers on pay rises, possibly, possibly not.
Yes.
But yeah, it's an interesting time, obviously, because we've got in 2017, I believe I'm right in saying, we're going to have the first round of binding votes on pay since Vince Cable's move to give shareholders that power. He put it in when he was in the coalition on a three-year cycle, and I think 2017 is going to be the first year where, until 2016, we had a big outcry against these big pay rises, but those votes against such pay increases, or the sort of larger minorities who opposed them, those were merely advisory votes. But next year, I believe they will be binding for many companies.
What about time too?
Yeah, so it's interesting that obviously the IA has proposed some ways in which companies could make their pay a bit more transparent, and better to suggest to them to better explain why bonuses have been paid for a given period, that kind of thing. It will be interesting to see how companies and their remuneration committees respond to these suggestions, with 2017 obviously very, very much around the corner.
Well, we cover pay a lot. Columnist Paul Jackson.
And I spoke to Paul about it.
Indeed,
yeah.
I saw it. It's good to quote your own experts.
It is, yeah. He was very helpful.
He knows what he's talking about.
He certainly does.
Yeah, and I hope other people, the IA, I can't believe they wouldn't read what he's writing, because it's pretty spot on.
Yeah, I think they would. Yeah.
Good. Right, just to round off the news, JD Weatherspoon statement, presumably the usual Brexit moaning, although it's taking on a slightly different hue this time.
Yeah, I'd say it is always a joy reading Tim Martin's little outbursts. He sort of takes a aim instantly. I think it was Merkel, Hollande and Juncker. He always has a bit of a blow at
those
guys.
What's he upset about this time?
Just their very being, really. but
interesting. It's his bullying Vine suppliers. Yeah. I couldn't quite get my head around what he was moaning about specifically.
Essentially, I mean, we have the shares on a sell, and since the referendum, that's been the wrong call. They've absolutely flown since the referendum. But on this trading update, they did fall, and partly for the reasons that were behind our rationale for suggesting investors sell the stock. The costs are likely to rise, basically, partly because of wages, partly because of the investment they're going to put into their current estate, which is going to rise to 60 million from 34 million the prior year. And margins are kind of looking around stable at about 7%, but that's not quite as good as it has been historically for them or their peers, really. So the margins were a big thing behind our sell tip, and we think that there's potential pressure there, even though they're guiding 7% for the full year. They can probably hit that, but going into the next few financial years, it's just they're a discounter in a tough market, and they've got a big workforce, which is, well, the percentage of their workforce which will be benefiting from the rise in the living wage or the national living wage is quite big, and that's a big cost. So it's a tough game. I mean, we'll see. I'm confident in our sell tip still. I didn't sort of remove it or change it on this in spite of the big rise since the referendum. And yeah, I think it's going to be the right call.
Yeah. You used to cover this sector, didn't you, Andrew? You were never a huge fan of Weatherspoon. Is that a personal distaste or a financial one?
I don't drink in their pubs, it must be said. But they don't own the freehold, which makes them a bit different to the other. They mainly operate a leasehold model, which makes them a bit different. But the margin issue has been the real problem for them. They've expanded quickly because you can with leases. You don't need the capital to expand the estate. They went for a big sales grab, but it came at the cost of margins, and that's persisted over a long period. So I think that's really where where the scepticism is with Weatherspoons. I think still, but I mean, but also you could say, you can flip that argument around and say they did build a lot of sales. And, if they could restore the margin, then you saw some evidence of that. That, you could have upside there. But I mean, the evidence, as Bradley says, is more to the downside at the moment.
And also, they've bought back, or rather Tim Martin has bought back a lot of shares. And I think actually the update before this, they said that they had to apply to city regulators to, basically, once one party owns 30%, they're obliged to make an offer for the group. And he had to apply to have that nullified because he was about to approach 30%. I mean, he's been buying a lot of shares, which probably helped the share price a bit as well. They made a statement in this update that they're planning to reduce their net debt to EBITDA ratio in the long term, however long that is, I don't know, but between 0 and 2 times. It's like 3.47 now. That's quite an ambitious goal. So they either need to make up a lot more cash or cut a lot of costs. I don't know. It just seems like a very bullish goal to achieve, and I'm not sort of sure of that myself.
No. Talking of trouble, Rolls-Royce, not a good week for them. I watched a documentary actually this week, the Panorama documentary on alleged corruption, and I guess this has really come out this week quite significantly.
Yeah, it has. I mean, I think it's linked to the sort of ongoing serious fraud office investigation into the company, which launched in December 2013. Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of our listeners will likely have either watched the BBC's Panorama programme, and I believe they tied up with The Guardian as well to do the story. And it basically kind of looks at the allegations that there were payments made to agents in various countries, which the allegations suggest then led to successful contract wins. I mean, Rolls-Royce, for their part, have made it clear that they do not tolerate business misconduct or inappropriate behaviour of any kind. And they also say that they are fully cooperating with authorities, and they can't comment beyond that because it's an ongoing investigation.
These must go back some way, these allegations, then.
I think they do, yeah. I think
preceding the change of management there.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a long story. It's a long, long story. It's been going on, it seems, a little while without sort of wanting to promote a rival. I mean, maybe, yeah, if for the a deep, in-depth analysis, obviously it was the BBC's and Guardian's story, one should maybe turn to the Panorama programme and have a look.
Yeah, I mean, I do. It's a funny one. I do like Rolls-Royce. I own their shares. They make great products. I'm surprised they feel the need to bribe people to sell them, because they really are best in class.
It is a strange thing. Yeah.
Which would make you think that perhaps, if it's true, this is simply the cost of doing business in certain jurisdictions.
Maybe. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Rolls-Royce is not the first company to have been accused of such behaviour. And other companies have even been found guilty of it. And as you say, while it is reprehensible in terms of sort of business practice and moral code and law here, in other countries, perhaps it's maybe the same, but not quite as strictly so. I don't know. I mean, yeah. I don't know, because I don't conduct business in multiple jurisdictions.
No. I mean, let's also face facts as well. We're talking about arms dealing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're worried that corruption is leaving a bad taste in your mouth, yeah. It's an arms dealer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay, perspective.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, illegal. So let's see what happens there.
Yeah.
Algie, should we move on to your excellent cover feature?
Oh, yes, yeah. Well,
You wrote the feature, designed the cover, even drew me a little picture.
Well, I have spent 10 years at the IC hoping to get zombies on the cover of the magazine. Well,
you've achieved your dream.
My work's done.
He's leaving.
But also, actually, at the 10 years I spent at the IC have seen a period in which value investing as a style has underperformed significantly, which is unusual, because there's a long historic trend and a lot of academic literature showing that value investing beats growth investing. So that's what the cover feature's on. It's just kind of a look at why this has happened, and what could happen now. Is there an argument that value is going to start outperforming again, as it historically has done?
Yeah, so I mean, value in principle, you know, we should be loving this, identifying underperforming shares that have been sold off perhaps too harshly by the market.
Yeah,
and you know, essentially bagging a bargain.
Yes,
but it's not been working, and it seems odd that it's not been working.
Yeah, no, because I mean the theory is that when shares underperform and they get cheap, what will happen in the round is that enough of them will come back, that you'll make more money by backing those cheap ones, and you will overpaying for what's already being priced into the shares, and then watch them disappoint and lose out. So. I mean, it's the arguments essentially. It's all based around reversion to the mean, which one of the interviewees for the piece kind of discusses quite a lot in it.
I mean, reversion to the mean has essentially gone out the window over the last 6 or 7 years, and some are suggesting that's because of the distorting impact of quantitative easing.
Yeah, so cheap financing just means a lot of uncompetitive companies
have, which we call,
stuck around. Zombies.
Zombies. See, there is a link.
There's a link. Well, also I think originally we were going to call the feature Death of Value. The Death of Value, which I think would have, you know, headline, it's a kind of good headline, but it's not quite what the piece is about, because it's not suggesting the phenomenon is dead.
Yes.
But it is saying it just hasn't worked for 10 years. Is there something deeper going on, or is it to do with the interest rate cycle, basically, which is the value investors who are...
Well, you say the interest rate cycle. It's not really been much of a cycle.
Yeah, exactly. So. The lack of an interest rate cycle. But also what we see now, and maybe it's another full storm, is obviously people are looking towards a second rate rise by the Fed and possibly tightening by other countries, and there's a lot of appetite, it seems, for interest rate rises at the moment, and bond yields are rising. So it looks like a scenario which could play in favour of value. But one of the interesting things with these value stocks is that although a lot of the people I spoke to did seem to have valuation arguments, when you look at the kind of bigger picture numbers, which is what I was really interested in looking at in this feature, you don't really see a very compelling argument for value as a whole. The P premium that growth stocks are valued at over value stocks has been fairly consistent for the last 10 years, unlike during the tech boom, for example, when it shot away. Price to book, these companies do look cheap, though. Cheaper, than growth stocks. And that does kind of feed into the idea that return on capital has been hurt by the quantitative easing type policies. So I mean that is a potential valuation argument. But
and we do have examples of value as working as a strategy in the past 10 years. I mean, Simon Thompson, for example, who you mentioned.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a value, his bargain shares in particular is a value
absolutely
approach.
It's a classic value approach. And obviously and then he goes in, he kind of uses a classic value approach to look for stocks, and then he kind of goes in and really gets involved with the nitty gritty. And then recommends stocks for that portfolio on that basis. So, and that's done fantastically. And then I've cited some other value fund managers whose funds have outperformed a lot over the period. I mean, you know, it's a strategy. Value investing does work on an individual, by investor to investor, but there's definitely been headwinds to that strategy.
Yeah.
And growth has been easier.
Enjoy the ride. But anyway, so value might become a bit easier if we see a return to a more normal interest rate cycle.
It may. And it could be really quite pronounced also, because when you start going down looking at the sectors, which are very important for value investors, the biggest one, the quarter of the MSCI Value Index actually are financials. And obviously financials are very sensitive to interest rates.
Mm.
And they're very out of favour at the moment for very good reasons.
Yeah, in fact, just skipping away at a tangent from your feature. The second feature this week is the final instalment of the SharePad series that they're from. And it's looking at banks.
Yeah.
And banks, you would suggest maybe there is an element of value about them at the moment.
Well, if you price to book, I mean, which a lot of people look at, you can make a very, very strong argument just looking at the price to book ratio.
Yeah, but I read that piece, and you know, I'm not a fan of bank shares at the moment. I think there's a lot, they do face some significant business headwinds, not just kind of market or stylistic headwinds. It doesn't make comfortable reading.
Every time you, fund managers that I've spoken to over the years since the crisis have talked about a recovery story in banks, and every time it feels like that's gaining traction, something else comes along. It's either part of their banks don't start performing, or there's more PPI, or...
I mean, I think though also what I mean, because we can all look at the banking sector, the banks, and go, oh my gosh, but that revulsion is
that's how you express revulsion, haven't you? Oh my gosh.
It's hard to continue on a train where I see you sniggering at me over the table, John. But I mean, that is one of the hallmarks of a really great contrarian case, when everyone has been so put off because they've disappointed again and again and again. And I'm not saying that means that, you know, that means we are going to see a big outperformance in banks. But one thing they definitely do have going for them is that if interest rates do rise and if the bond yield keeps on steepening, then their profits work off of that. And also the ratings of their shares work off of that, or that historically they have.
Having said that,
can you think, what more can they come out with to put people off? Surely, you know, we must be close to the point of maximum revulsion.
I just worry. So, you know, if the interest rate cycle starts to turn in their favour again, that other cycles might turn against them.
That's the odd place we're in, though, isn't it? Because normally you associate interest rate cycles with the improvements in the economy. And is that really what people are just trying to... The banks seem to be more interested in normalising interest rates or getting to a normal position when times are still not too bad.
Yeah. I mean, so we have, for example, Julie Dean... A leading fund manager is interviewed in the fund section this week, and she suggests that we may actually be already in a down leg of the economic cycle here in the UK. You can kind of sense that there's some truth to that. Mm-hmm. I think Chris Benodi, the hedge fund manager, who was a Brexiteer, so you know, takes some gumption to say this, but I mean, he's talking about an imminent UK recession this week. So you know, yeah, the normalisation of interest rates might work for the bank, but other headwinds may emerge.
I mean, also that what Crispin Odie was saying as well was so linked to the what's happened to Sterling, and now suddenly we're seeing, as we were talking about earlier, that Sterling's kind of reviving. And I mean, we're
it's not reviving that much.
No, a little bit. But yeah, as Braddy was saying, a Trump win, you know, who knows? I mean, obviously that, and there's the article, you know, Article 53.
But that could get challenged. That could go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, of course it could. We're all over the place at the moment. It's been a crazy time.
Well, it's lucky we're hosting an event on diversification this evening. So, yeah, we'll be writing that up in the foreseeable future once we've had it. But yeah, all over the place. Okay, so Algie, yeah, any concluding remarks on the springing to life of value strategies?
I think a lot of it could come down to the rate cycle. And we have just had a month where value has outperformed quite well. So, I mean, which does link in the idea that, expectations that rates are heading up.
That's because at our last event a month ago, you said that growth was better.
This marries up with that analysis, actually, because my argument at the growth event was that people should be paying far more attention to the price they're paying for growth.
Yes.
And so in a way, I mean, it was saying, listen, growth has been doing really well, but also watch out because the markets are expensive and you want to make sure you're not overpaying, because you don't want to be caught out on the way down by a massive derating.
Yes.
Which is a real danger for growth stocks.
Listen to Hall. He knows the future. Right.
I'm afraid not. But the rearview mirror can tell us a few things.
But it can indeed. Okay, it's the only thing that can tell us where the future might go. Anyway, enough philosophising on the nature of history. Any results this week, Bradley, that you wanted to point out?
Well, I mean, it's pretty sparse in the results section at the moment, but I think we're going to have a bit of a bump in a few weeks when a few more results come forward. But I mean, I only actually covered one myself this week, so I guess I'll talk about that one.
Go on.
It's a group which people might not know the name of. It's C&C.
They will
know the brands, Magnus and Bulmers, I'm sure, which are drinks that these guys produce. They had a bit of a tough one. We've got them on a buy. I don't think it's a tip. It's a mini buy, as we kind of colloquially say in the office. But yeah, their main markets are Ireland and Scotland, and I think there probably was a mention of weather in there, maybe.
Oh, no.
a big thing in Scotland actually was there was some drink drive legislation implemented in the back end of 2014,
yes,
I think.
Yes, it's true.
And so there was a lot of competition in Scotland last year and still this year to kind of just find the new sort of normal level of the market. So Scotland's actually quite a tough time for them, and it's quite a key market for them. And generally, supermarket price deflation has been problematic for them too. They have sort of seen their prices drop a little bit, and there's demand from the supermarkets for things like smaller packaging from them, so preference for aluminium cans over bottles, and bottles would retail for a higher price, so that's a bit problematic too. So yeah, it's all a bit pressurized at the moment, but they are kind of expanding slowly their joint ventures, which help them access the US market, but that is quite small at the moment, so not anywhere near enough to offset what is their very much their key markets of Ireland, Scotland, and England and Wales.
Yeah, it was never a favourite of mine when I was covering drinks. I thought the whole cider boom was a bit faddish, and their acquisitions looked a bit low rent.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Magnus and Bulmers aren't, their market shares in the UK are just huge, which is part of the reason why I've kept them ever so slightly begrudgingly on a buy. But I just think that those brands are going to endure what is a tough time in retail. The supermarkets are rationalising brands, they're stocking fewer names, but I can't see them not stocking Magnus and Bulmers. So it feels like there's a base for me where C&C is concerned, so that's why I'm kind of sticking with it for now.
All right. Fair enough. So, we haven't got many results, as you say. Debenhams is another interesting one in there. Pick Up Magazine, have a look at that. Not been going so well there, but
well, there's obviously a bit of change going on, because their new chief executive, I think, has just started or is in the process of taking over from his incumbent. The new chief exec wasn't on the call. He wants to kind of, he's obviously getting his head down. I think he has literally just joined and will be present at the next update from them, obviously, which will be very, very key, because the high street's a tough old place at the moment. We had an update from Next, I think, this week or the back end of last week, and they were finding things difficult. I think full price sales were down slightly, but their discounted sales were going okay, but it just shows you that's just it's just such a tough area to be operating in.
So. Yeah, yeah, and you know, kind of that toughness on the high street. I mean, some of that is going to be the fault of the rise of internet shopping, but some of it, is down to the fact that households are somewhat nervous and conservative in their spending habits at the moment, which kind of chimes with what we were saying about the strength of the UK economy.
Yeah.
So yes, let's take a cautious approach, I would suggest. Okay, brilliant. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Algie. I think we've run through the main things in the magazine this week. Only a few results, but we have an interesting sector focus on South African mining from Alex Newman, another out-of-favour sector, which has seen some green shoots recently. Lots in the personal finance and funds section. It's jam-packed, and lots, of course, of comment from Simon Thompson and Chris Dillo and The Trader and Bearable, as usual. Zombies on the cover. It's a week late. Halloween was this Monday. Unfortunately, we had the Investment Trust special, which we couldn't really move, given that it's pretty important, but we got there in the end. After 10 years of inferior returns, is value investing coming back to life? Let's hope so. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening. Pick up the magazine, all good news agents, £4.70, or go online and subscribe. Thank you very much, and see you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.